Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush. Almost said welcome to the podcast like Josh does. In here in the studio with everyone's favorite new cinephile, Casey Pegram. Well, you're an old cinephile.
Yeah.
You're new to them.
That's true.
That's what I meant. And we are here for part two of the Stanley Kubrick, I say three part. I know it's going to be longer than that. The Stanley Kubrick, what are we calling this?
It's a special deep dive.
Deep dives?
I don't know. Miniseries?
Miniseries. I like that. And we, or I rather, had the great pleasure of watching Casey's pick for the second film in this series, Barry Lyndon, last night for the very first time.
Yeah.
Last night slash this morning.
Uh-oh. Do you have to break it up? Or it just went past midnight?
No. Here's the deal is while I'm – it takes a lot longer to watch these because I will pause to make my notes because I don't want to miss shit.
Yeah.
So it was like 11:45 and I still had an hour and 15 minutes to go.
Had you even gotten to like part two yet?
I had still, gotten,
okay,
I was
you
in
just
part
started
two.
Part two. Okay, yeah.
And it wasn't like, oh my God, this is so slow and this is so boring, because we'll get into that because that's a common criticism.
Yeah.
I was way into it. I was just like, I got to finish this.
Yeah, sure.
To be my best self.
Sure.
So this is kind of fun, Casey, because we get to kind of just dive in.
I know.
Let's talk Barry Lyndon.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it, not to throw it on you first, but, I watched this. I've seen this probably between 10 and 15 times.
Dude, that's great.
I started watching it in high school, and it seems like I get around to it about once a year.
Yeah. This may be one of those for me. I loved it.
Yeah. I've seen it theatrically, I think, two or three times.
I've got to do that.
Yeah. That is like the ideal way to see it.
Yeah.
The Landmark here in Atlanta played it on film, actually.
Oh, wow.
Two or three years ago.
Where is that?
Movie Crush alumnus Scott was there. I saw him.
Oh,
bumped
yeah.
Into him in the lobby. By Midtown Art is what I mean.
Oh, Landmark. Okay.
Yeah.
It
was like a beat up 35 print. So it wasn't like it actually, the Blu-ray looks much better.
Yeah.
But it was still very charming and wonderful to be able to see it on film.
Oh,
anyway.
So Scotty was there?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Of course he was.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
All you nerds hanging out.
Yeah. And I mean, I've seen it a couple times overseas. And, I just watched this most recent time, night before last. The Criterion Blu-ray, which is like a newer restoration,
right?
4K scan,
mm-hmm.
Looks impeccable.
Yeah.
And just the movie just gets better every time I see it. So,
yeah. Well, everyone, I streamed it and it is available to stream if you're an Amazon Prime member. So that's the good news. If you're signed up for Prime, you can watch Barry Lyndon if you have 3 hours and good taste.
Yeah. And it looked pretty good on Prime.
Yeah, man, it looked great. Yeah. You know, I've got a pretty good TV.
Good.
Although now that you've talked about the OLEDs, I'm totally like...
got the bug.
Jelly about that. I fucking loved it, man. Like, all the criticisms, and I guess if you haven't seen it yet, you should know that it was a bit of a flop.
Yeah.
Kind of his only flop.
Not well received, and critically or financially.
I mean...
It won some Technical Academy Awards.
Sure.
Like costume design and that kind of thing.
But cinematography, of course.
Yeah.
David Alcott,
mm-hmm.
Amazing. Yep.
John Alcott, I think.
John Alcott?
Yeah.
I think David something was the set designer.
Yes.
He won as well.
Yeah. I just watched, I went through all the extras. And there's a whole segment on, of course, the cinematography, but also the set designer.
That's just gorgeous.
Who had a full-on nervous breakdown during that film.
Yeah. What was up with that? Just too much?
It was because he worked on a lot of the James Bond films,
mm-hmm.
and he also worked on Dr. Strangelove. He designed the bunker, that famous bunker set.
Oh, cool.
So incredible. And
the war room?
Yeah, the war room, exactly. and Kubrick had asked him to do 2001 as well,
uh-huh.
and he turned it down because he just knew Kubrick was going to drive him insane with logic, with asking him,
right.
Why this?
Yeah.
Why does it have to be this way? What is the logical justification? And he just wants to be like... Because it looks cool, Stanley, you know?
Yeah.
And
that
so,
doesn't fly with Stanley Kubrick.
So he knew, like, to get between Stanley Kubrick and NASA and try to, you know, he just was not up to that challenge.
Right.
Mentally, you know? He said that working with Kubrick was, like, one of the best experiences in terms of the work that he did. He thought The War Room was the best set he ever made.
Yeah.
And I think he's right. But, you know, he just could not go there. And then when Barry Lyndon came around, Kubrick went to him again. and said, I can only pay you half of your normal rate, but will you do this?
And I need you to
And
he
said, you made this very easy, Stanley. No, I'm not going to do it.
Right.
And like 6 weeks went by and then Kubrick came back to him and said, all right, I'll pay you your normal rate. Please come do this movie.
Wow.
And but the thing that was tricky from a set design perspective is they didn't build sets.
Right.
It's all on real locations these old houses. And so
castles and
And during the production, apparently, it just got to a point where he said he literally was questioning every decision to the point where he had no bearings anymore. And he basically had to like take some time off, go to therapy, and like build himself back up and remember all his accomplishments and everything and kind of get to the point where he could make a judgment call and feel at all confident about it because Kubrick had just kind of broken him down, but he did win the Academy Award. So,
yeah. He can sit around and stare at that.
Yeah.
Man, that's crazy and also believable. And I know that he spent like a full year in Ireland before. I mean, it was a year of prep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And by the way, I know you know everything I'm going to say.
Sure.
But for those of you out there who don't know, the backstory is Mr. Kubrick was going to do a film. And his entire career wanted to do this Napoleon film.
Mm-hmm.
But a movie came out called Waterloo, which did not perform well right around that time. So he scrapped it. But he had done all this research on the time period and did not want that to go to waste. So he picked up the book, the Thackeray book.
He was going to do – he looked at Vanity Fair first.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
And he liked a lot about Vanity Fair, but he felt like it's too much to condense. There's too much event. The scope is too big. So – he didn't really see how it would work as a movie, and that's what brought him around to The Luck of Barry Lyndon, which is the title of the book.
Yeah, so he had all this knowledge about the time period, very famously composed this movie based on paintings.
Yes.
Yeah, who were they?
So it was Gainsborough, Hogarth, and Stubbs were some of the painters, and he wanted to go primarily with paintings from the same era that he's depicting.
Yeah.
So like 18th century, but he cheated a little bit and went back a little further and went a little more ahead as well to kind of, you know, it's about a 300-year span that he's drawing from for the paintings.
Well, it's amazing when you're seeing some of these shots, it's so clearly the frame and the composition is so clearly mimicking a painting.
Yes.
But also like there were so many shots like that where there was virtually no movement from anyone, maybe their hands. And of course, that one great, great shot when the kid comes and wakes
Lord
him
Bullingdon,
up
yes.
at the end and
what
everyone
an incredible
is just
shot.
Like
yeah.
just sitting dead still.
And that one is just like a direct reference to a painting.
Yeah. Yeah
and the posture of him in the chair and everything.
Oh, yeah. I'd seen that painting,
which
is awesome. But so many times in this movie too, later on, in that, well, I want to say third act. It's the third act, but it's part two.
Yeah.
They have these compositions where they look like a painting and they are surrounded by those same paintings.
Yes.
Like sometimes
yes.
very large on the wall.
Yeah.
And it's
that
really
huge one when he's reading the book to his kid.
Yep.
And I was watching one of the features and they talked about how that painting is of sort of people in high society.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is almost that you're seeing this, you know, Irish kind of scoundrel who has elevated himself to this place in high society. And it's like they've almost kind of, you know, they don't belong there quite, you know?
Yeah.
And so the painting is like a kind of a commentary on that.
Uh-huh.
And then at the same time, it's there at the end of the film, one of the last shots, where you see Lady Lyndon like paying all her bills.
Yeah, yeah.
And just kind of shaking her head as she has to write the 500, you know, check to, what is it, 500
guineas.
Yeah.
To
500 guineas.
Basically a lifetime payoff.
Yeah.
To just leave.
And the same painting is in the background.
Yeah.
And in that instance, it doubles almost as sort of like, in the painting, it's people that are very prosperous.
Mm-hmm.
And yet within the room itself, it's about a family kind of in decline now financially.
Yeah, and I know sometimes people listen to these without having seen the film yet, which is a great compliment, I think, just to us.
You really should watch it.
But you should watch it, but just the quickest of recaps so you know what we're talking about is Barry Lyndon is a film about an, I want to say con man.
Yeah, kind of.
But what I think the actual child in the movie puts it best, he's a common opportunist. and that's the best way to describe him. He's an Irishman, sort of a rogue who And it's one of my favorite things in movies when the story is sort of happens to the character.
Yeah.
And every event lead, you know, as the movie goes, he's sort of forced to do the next thing that leads to the next thing.
Yeah.
And I think Roger Ebert even said, you know, this is a character who life happens to him.
Yes. Yeah.
And so he eventually works his way into the high society after being a British soldier and then a Prussian soldier.
Mm-hmm. And like a spy.
And a spy, yeah. And assuming the identity, stealing an identity.
Being kind of like
an officer.
A gambler, a sort of,
yep.
You know, not even a gambler. He was like the gambler's assistant that helps him cheat, basically.
Yeah, yeah, the Chevalier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's what the movie's about. And it's basically just sort of this three-hour journey of this character. And I guess let's talk a little bit about Ryan O'Neal.
Yeah.
He was cast as Barry Lyndon, Redmond Barry, who becomes Barry Lyndon once he marries Lady Lyndon, mm-hmm. for her money.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also, you know, super hot.
Yeah.
But had more to do with her money.
Yeah. And she in particular, like if you look at this Gainsborough portraits, like that's very much the kind of classical beauty look that she has,
yeah.
is what that painter kind of went towards.
Yeah, and Kubrick apparently told her like to not go outside for like 4 months preceding the film.
She's pretty pale.
So
yeah.
Like everyone in the movie, well, some are straight up powdered.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But everyone is just the pallor, yes. and the paleness,
yes.
is very evident.
Yeah.
So
Ryan O'Neal.
Yeah, yeah. Ryan O'Neal got a
big star at the time.
Very divisive, know? Casting call.
Yeah.
Still remains so because a lot of people say this is a masterpiece, but for his acting.
Mm.
And I disagree.
Yeah, I disagree as well. Yeah.
So what's your take?
I mean, you know, Kubrick definitely did, just in terms of like strategic box office logic.
Sure.
He wanted a name. He wanted a leading man. Ryan O'Neal had done that movie Love Story.
Oh, sure. One of the biggest movies ever.
Yeah. And he'd also, I think at this point, he had worked with Peter Bogdanovich on Paper Moon, I want to say, with Tatum,
yep.
O'Neal.
He was in What's Up, Doc, which,
yeah.
is a huge movie.
Yeah.
He was a big, big,
so
handsome
he was,
movie
He was a big
star.
Name. It was kind of like, you know, in the 90s when Kubrick cast Tom Cruise, for instance.
Right.
It's that kind of idea of like,
mm-hmm.
I'm making a very like demanding film, but I'm going to put like a big name at the center of it.
Yeah.
And that will kind of hedge some of the box office,
right?
You know,
and he was coming off a bunch of successes as well. Kubrick was,
yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he was.
He had made Clockwork Orange just before this, and
uh-huh.
2001 before that,
yep.
and Strangelove before that. So yeah, that's three in a row.
They were kind of all in a row, though, when you think about it.
yeah, 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 yeah. Well, you know, like Barry Lyndon kind of like shook him a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's why, in part, why he then makes The Shining afterwards, because
right.
he wants more like a genre,
mm-hmm.
sure thing, audience-pleasing kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, whether or not it ultimately did please an audience to watch The Shining, but...
I love that. Was it, The Shining was his big give.
Yeah, yeah,
to,
yeah.
Like,
that's like the one for them.
Making.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, in one of the extras, they're talking about the performance style in Kubrick films. We kind of touched on this in the last podcast, that Kubrick does tend to direct actors in a kind of stylized way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always particularly naturalistic.
Yeah.
And in Barry Lyndon, you have Ryan O'Neal doing a more kind of restrained, mm-hmm. flat kind of performance.
Yeah.
But everybody around him, for the most part, is a little bit like amped up, a little bit, you
yeah.
know, there's some really like, you know, Captain Quinn at the beginning of the movie is
oh
so funny. Like,
dude,
he's
so
just
funny.
Such a tool. Like, and,
yeah,
and
he's
you know,
so over the top.
Yeah, yeah. And like, just his expressions
yeah.
and, you know, the faces he makes. And,
so
you know, it's he's like being ridiculed.
It feels like a black comedy in
yeah,
that first part.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so I think Ryan O'Neal having that kind of flat quality
mm-hmm.
just brings out, you know, the contrast of everybody else around him.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe also makes him a little bit more of a figure you can identify with because
yeah.
you're able to kind of project your own feelings and emotions and
yeah.
things onto him because he's not going so over the top with what he's doing.
Yeah. And that's the character too. Like Redmond Barry was a man out of place.
Yeah.
A man who didn't want to be given away
yeah.
like or give up his hand.
Yeah.
So he was... While he was a con man in a way, it was always very subtle, and I feel like he was just trying to not be found out.
Yeah.
So I think it fit the role.
Absolutely.
You know?
And it also kind of goes with what you were saying about things happen to him.
Yeah.
He's less of an actor. He's less, you know, actor in the sense of doing things, uh-huh. of being active. He's kind of a passive person.
Yeah.
And sort of a cowardly person, too, in a way. Although, when we first see him, you know, when he's young, when he's Redmond Barry.
Right.
He's a young man, and he falls in love with his cousin, and he is kind of motivated more by passion and emotion.
Yeah.
And it's because he really, you feel like he really believes in something. Uh-huh. He's really like, he's acting more on genuine emotion. Whereas,
well, and hormones.
Yeah,
let's be
of course,
honest.
Of course.
Like
yeah.
he's young
and youthful,
and horny.
Naivete yeah. and all that. But, you know, as he gets older, as he sort of ascends the class ladder, the rankings of society, he becomes more and more kind of removed and distant and cold. Mm-hmm. And about the only thing you can say about him that is redeeming near the end of the film is just the love that he has for his son, his biological son.
Yeah.
You know, that he does seem to genuinely care about that kid. And uh-huh. that's about the only thing. He treats his wife terribly.
Yeah.
He treats his stepson terribly.
Oh, God.
He, you know, he's only interested in kind of ascending rank and gaining this title so that he'll have some financial security. We can get into that more later. But, you know, he gradually kind of loses who he was, mm-hmm. and he just becomes this kind of blank slate.
But that's kind of how they are. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It was definitely a comment on the upper crust and just sort of the vapid coldness.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we said time and time again, and we will as we continue the series, Stanley Kubrick's films have never been described as warm,
right?
Character-wise, and that does create a bit of an arm's length for an audience, but it's all very purposeful. I don't think it's like an accident,
absolutely,
or yeah. like, oh man, I just didn't get the emotion of this, because when Ryan O'Neill is tasked in really two big scenes to emote, mm-hmm. When the captain dies,
yeah.
to the sort of in the creek, yeah. to the side of the battlefield,
right,
and when his son dies. He brings it, and that shit is real.
Oh, yeah. Those are very affecting scenes,
yeah,
I think,
so,
especially his son.
Yeah, so that, to me, kind of just proves that he was – it was all very purposeful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not like Ryan O'Neill acted poorly
in
this movie.
All.
I
not
think he
all.
Was tasked to be removed and cold and distant and flat.
The typical kind of Kubrickian
Which
protagonist.
Which is kind of hard, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it does have to be hard to just keep withholding for,
yeah.
you know, for – A year, yeah. 6 months, however long they were shooting, a long time.
I love a favorite scene of mine was when he was robbed on the trail.
Yes.
By
the gentleman robber.
Yeah, what's Feeney?
Yeah, Feeney, yes.
Who was a legendary highwayman.
Yeah.
He had the double guns out,
yeah,
which is so cool
looking. Yeah.
But that scene was so funny, and there were a lot of sort of darkly comic moments.
Yes.
Where, but again, things happened to him. Like, had he dined with them.
Yeah.
Which he had the offer to previously, he would not have been – it would have thrown off the timeline.
Yeah.
And he would not have been robbed on the trail. His horse would not have been taken.
Yeah.
He would have ended up in Dublin.
Yeah.
Instead, he had to join the British Army. And that kind of kicked everything in a completely different direction.
Derailed whatever his trajectory was going to be.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And he just kind of went with it.
Yeah.
Or he did what he had to do, I guess.
Yeah. Who knows what would have happened to him if he'd wound up in Dublin. He would have could have lived an entirely different life.
Yeah, but that's not a fun movie.
No, yeah, but that's what's so charming about the film in a way, I think, is that you are just following somebody's life, and they're not even particularly maybe the most interesting person from this time period to look after, but it's almost his own mediocrity that gives you the best vantage point to just look at the society itself, because he himself is kind of an absence in a way. So you're encouraged to look at the periphery at what all is happening around him, that he's just being swept up in the current of history.
Yep.
A bit like Forrest Gump or something, you know,
yeah,
in a weird way.
In a very weird way.
Yeah.
Well, there were so many times when I was watching this where I was like, oh, that – I'm surprised I didn't think of Forrest Gump because that's kind of a perfect analogy. But where I saw so many films that had clearly been just stealing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
From Barry Lyndon.
Yeah.
And not just Kubrick, but like Barry Lyndon
very specifically. Yes. Yeah.
Like, of course, Wes Anderson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who fully admits it.
The way Wes Anderson uses zooms oftentimes is very reminiscent of what Kubrick, the same way Kubrick used them.
And the narration, I think, was very reminiscent of Tannenbaum's.
Yes. Yes.
The sort of omniscient narrator who sometimes would, in this movie, would say things right before they happened.
Yeah, and sometimes even a little bit in advance of them happening. So there's that line of voiceover about, you know, you're watching a scene of Barry playing outside with his kid. I think they're playing like croquet or something.
Yeah,
and the narration is just, you know, but fate would have it that, you know,
that's
Barry
right.
would end his life poor, destitute, and childless, something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and his family line would end with him, essentially.
Oh, that's right.
And it almost
that's
goes
really
by without you completely processing it at the time. But it's telling you, like, this kid's going to die. He's going to lose everything.
Yeah.
And yet when you're looking at on the screen, none of that has, you know, really begun to show itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And it happens a little bit afterwards. And Kubrick talked a lot about that voiceover being so valuable in the viewing of the film for the viewer, because by prefiguring a lot of this stuff, by kind of gently nudging you, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, it makes things feel a little bit more like fate. It makes things feel a little bit more set in stone.
Right.
And when they happen, they arrive with a feeling of like necessity or like it had to go this way.
Right.
So it feels less like he's just being bounced around and like, you know, things are just like arbitrarily happening one after the other. Everything kind of feels like it has a purpose and it's happening, you know, and it is the voiceover that lends it that quality. If you were to watch the film without that voiceover,
I wondered about that.
It'd be very different.
What that would be like.
Yeah.
And usually I'm not, I mean, I do love well done voiceover, but this is the kind of voiceover I usually would be like, no, man, that's not how you do it.
Yeah.
It's too on the nose.
Yeah.
It's too telegraphed.
Show, don't tell kind of thing.
Yeah. But it fucking worked somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's fascinating too, because apparently this really surprised me, even though we talked last time about Kubrick changing things up last minute.
Yeah.
But that voiceover came entirely in post. It was not part of like a screenplay. It was not structured that way. And that amazes me, because the film as the final product feels so carefully and deliberately constructed that I'm really surprised that he didn't have this device in mind.
Yeah,
maybe he had thought about it, but it wasn't formalized in like a screenplay sense.
He may have known all along.
Yeah, but until well into the editing.
Yeah.
And they tried different things. They tried different narrators and different. So it's just, I mean, even when they were shooting and prepping and everything, like the screenplay, Liam Vitale talks about this, where it would just say, like, Barry faces off in a duel against, you know, Captain Quinn.
Yeah.
That's the whole scene.
Then
the next scene is like Barry gets robbed in the woods.
Wow.
That's the whole scene. So, you know, Liam Vitale describes getting handed the screenplay and just looking, and like every scene was just like a descriptor of what it is.
But so there's no dialogue yet even?
There's no dialogue yet.
When did he deliver that?
So they actually started shooting and he still didn't really have much of a screenplay put together other than just he had like the framework. Like he had the events in order and like the two-part structure I think he probably had. But all the specifics of the dialogue and everything was still like TBD. And so they shot for 6 weeks in Ireland. Then Kubrick basically said, all right, you know what? I'm kind of getting a better feel for what I want this movie to be. We're going to shut down production and just like come back in January and pick it up again. And so he like went away for something like—
How long was that?
6 or 9 weeks, something like that.
Okay.
And like actually kind of wrote it for real that time.
Wow.
And then they came back, and also somewhere in there, I don't know if it was, but at some point the IRA actually threatened Kubrick and his family.
And he fucking left.
He did. He was like, all right, that's a wrap on Ireland. You know, we're going to go back to England and a little bit in Germany and so on.
Yeah. So did he not go back to Ireland after that?
I don't think he went back. He did not want to mess with the IRA.
Yeah, because that was mid-70s.
Yes. Oh, that was height of the troubles. Yeah.
Yeah, not good.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the— It's not a war movie. There are scenes of battle and there are some army stuff, the Seven Years' War.
Yeah.
But I definitely would not classify it as a war film.
No.
And usually this, I mean, I guess you get some stuff with movies like Vanity Fair, but this time period, I feel like you see a lot of war movies set during this time, but not a lot of 3-hour character studies.
Right, right.
About this time period.
Yeah.
But the war stuff was amazing.
Oh, it's incredible. That's the part that he carried over from all the research and work that he did on Napoleon.
Yeah.
When he was prepping Napoleon.
I know it's all very accurate.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah, I think they're shooting on like maybe the real battlefields where stuff happened.
Yeah, and how war went down and like everything in this movie
it's crazy to look at how they used to fight wars.
Rule oriented, whether it's the fist fight or you know the bare knuckle brawl, or the war or the dueling, like it's all or the card games.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
everything had rules back then. Yeah, and Kubrick knew them all.
Yeah, and there's still something very like barbaric about it all, but society puts this veneer of respectability on it by enclosing it within these quote unquote rules. But I think
you don't hide in the woods. You march right at each other.
Exactly.
And maybe you get lucky and shoot people or maybe you get unlucky and catch a bullet.
Yeah. You literally just march in a giant row towards the other army.
Yeah.
When you get into firing range, they just start shooting you.
Yeah.
And the whole first line just like goes down, you know.
Yep.
If you're lucky, maybe the bullet hits the guy next to you or something. Yeah. But that there's literally like no skill involved in not getting shot. You're just marching
or shooting
in a line. Yeah, I know.
Like, the dueling.
Yeah.
Just, and Josh and I did a show on dueling. It was more like, will the gun work?
Yeah.
Rather than how good is your aim?
Yeah, yeah.
Because like at the final duel,
oh man,
he's pointed right at his head and he shoots him below the knee.
Yeah.
10 feet.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, so those, and his gun misfired to begin with.
I love that
like
scene.
Those things just sucked. Yeah, we'll put a pin in
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, in terms of talking about rules, that's a very interesting look at rules and the idea of acting honorably and so on.
But those war scenes are amazing.
Yeah.
And what was so cool is they're marching toward the French troops and the French are firing. And so you get that bit of a battle. But the main battle, like I guess eventually you get close enough to where you're bayoneting.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
you can
kind of
hear them.
Yeah.
Like you hear them firing. They fire maybe like three kind of rounds where they fire, reload, fire, reload.
Yep.
And, you know, his good friend gets hit. And so he carries him off to the creek. And you just kind of hear in the background like the, like you can tell they've gotten to the bayonet phase. But
it was an interesting way to play it.
Yeah. You never really see it. And you realize how quickly a battle like that kind of just plays itself out, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like the trench warfare of like World War One that Kubrick looked at in Paths of Glory.
Right.
Where it's like 6 months to gain, you know, an inch basically of territory and just meaningless chaos and death.
Yeah, this felt like 45 minutes
if
it was played out in real time.
And they even say in the narration, like, this battle never made it to the history books, but everybody there found it memorable enough.
Right.
It's fascinating. And the whole point of the battle was because there was like another battalion that was going to like be marching down that road and they didn't want the French soldiers there when they came along. So they're basically just kind of like clearing a path. Yeah. And it's just kind of, I mean, there's a deep absurdity there that the narration touches on lightly without overdoing it. But it's just enough to let you know, like, this kind of stuff happened all the time.
Right.
And it really didn't amount to a hill of beans, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting character-wise, too, because Redmond Barry, as much as we say, like, he doesn't have any particular talents and things just happen to him.
Yeah.
He is a great fencer.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good shot.
Yep.
He is a great fighter.
Yeah.
Because he kicks that guy's ass, who's a lot bigger.
You don't expect him to win that fight, but he knows what he's doing.
He never gets hit.
Yeah.
And then he kind of becomes a bit of a war hero, like, for real, like— He not only in the first battle carries his
good friend,
his first father figure,
yeah.
you know, which is there's a lot of daddy stuff in this
sure,
movie.
Sure, sure.
Because right at the beginning, he has lost his father in a duel.
Yeah.
And he's constantly seeking that father figure.
That's right, yeah.
But he carries him off the field and cares for him. He also gets to skip that battle. But then he saves, what's his name? I think it's Potsdorf.
Potsdorf. And I want to make sure it's not Potsdam because that's one of the locations. But I think it is Potsdorf.
Yeah, I think it's Potsdorf. He saves him for real. Like everyone else leaves in that outpost and he goes back in and lifts the fucking thing off of him.
And that's after Potsdorf was the one who got him.
Yeah,
you know, conscripted him into the Prussian army in the first place. You kind of busted him when, you know, his story didn't add up.
Yeah, it's interesting character-wise, though, that he actually showed valor.
He does have these moments of heroism where he does kind of rise to the occasion. And
but it's not played in a big movie way.
Yeah.
It's just very Kubrickian.
But then later, you know, when he's recounting his kind of glory days to his son, you can tell he embellishes these stories and talks about beheading, like, 19 Frenchmen. And, you know, that's a sign that his character has kind of a real shift in his character that he couldn't just relate the true story of this heroic thing that he did.
Mm-hmm.
He had to invent some ridiculous thing about all these beheadings and, you know, just it's like he loses like his authentic self and he's just a phony, like even to his own son.
Yeah. He is a good father in a way. I don't know. Good's a weird word.
Yeah.
For the time period, he's a very doting father.
Yes, yeah.
But that is mirrored by the mistreatment of Lord Bullington.
Yes.
And just what a fucking asshole he is to
Absolutely.
Him. But he's that way, I mean, it's not justified, but he's that way because Bullington is just so close to Lady Lyndon.
I mean, Bullington has like
he figures him out at 10 years old.
Exactly. He has his number the whole time. So
the whole time.
And he's not quiet about it.
No.
So there is that they just have a mutual disdain for each other.
Yeah, I mean, he's the one that said at the very beginning, "I find him nothing more than a common opportunist." I'm like, damn, that kid's 10.
It's a sharp kid.
And he was right, you know.
He was
right about everything.
Yeah, and it seems to drive a wedge even between him and his mother. Sadly, mm-hmm. because you know later on, even though he's still kind of in that mama's boy, like when it first cuts to adult Bullington.
Yeah.
He's like on the grass.
It
like,
was Leon Vitale.
Yeah. And he's sitting kind of almost in his mother's lap still watching this magician
He's holding
perform.
Her hand. It's Oedipally creepy.
But, you know, she has some commentary. You know, it's in the scene where he brings, you know, the child into the concert. And, you know, the mother says something to the effect of, I'm trying to remember how she phrases it, but basically like, I would have loved you or I could have been closer to you had you not been such a pain in the ass with, you know, Barry.
Which is, I mean, it's so shitty. I mean, he goes away.
Yeah.
On his own accord, but he stays gone for, you know, a large chunk.
Yeah.
Although, you know, he's going to come back.
You get the Chekhov's gun. He has to come back. Yeah. before we get off the subject of the battles, I did want to say, like, Kubrick originally, like we were talking about, he was going to make this film Napoleon.
Right.
And the battle scenes in Barry Lyndon are like an indicator of what Napoleon might have been towards, but Napoleon was going
to
be even way more, almost unimaginably larger scale, where he was literally going to rent soldiers from the Romanian army.
Wow.
Like tens of thousands. Some scenes were going to involve like 40,000 people.
Holy shit.
And he had this amazing idea where, you know, because you have to make uniforms for that many people, that just the budgetary requirements to make those kind of uniforms period accurate and so on would have been
pre-CG, obviously.
Just incredible. So he came up with this idea. I think they did make these uniforms and test them out on camera where like the first row of soldiers that's closest to camera were going to be in these real, you know, accurate fabric, accurate period kind of aged costumes. But as you progressively moved further back in the rows, eventually you would get to people that were wearing this kind of paper fiber uniform that was very, very cheap material, but would still photograph well from a distance, look accurate and not tear easily and so on, that could be made for like $1 to $4 per uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was how he was going to achieve, again, shooting these like reenactments of battles on the actual battlefields where these battles occurred.
Yeah.
And of course, he was going to probably, to the best of his ability from historians and so on, have the same battle formations and positions and all that was going to be represented on screen very, very accurately. So
it makes a difference, man. I mean, it's easy to say like, oh, come on, like you don't really need to.
Yeah.
But there's an authenticity to his films and
somehow
especially this one, it really does come through.
Yeah.
Like you can tell none of this is fake.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not only because it's obviously the early 70s, but it feels like you're watching real life unfold.
You're just like immersed in the, you know, every conceivable aspect of the history has been thought through and considered from the locations to the, you know, the costumes to, and, you know, he talks about how it's absurd for, you know, to be doing a period piece and to hire like a costume designer to do something like inspired by the period.
Right.
They just copied it all from paintings and photo, you know, not photographs, but paintings and etchings and drawings and so on. Because why would you invent when you could just do the actual real thing?
Yeah.
You're never going to get it exactly right if you just try to make something inspired by. So just do the thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's pretty great.
Yeah.
Well, on the actual shooting, not only of that battle scene, because I did watch a little like 20-minute thing where they talked specifically about the 600 feet of dolly track they laid, and they had three cameras going. But you probably know more about this than me, but I know that Kubrick worked with NASA to get
lenses,
specially crafted lenses,
yes,
to not only allow these long, super long shots like on the battlefield, but to allow the maximum amount of light for, because we got to start talking about candlelit scenes.
Yeah, like, the NASA lenses would not have been used for any of the exteriors, I believe. Those would have been. Kubrick had a particular zoom that he really loved using that he uses throughout the movie, where you start on these tight close-ups,
yeah,
and then it's a slow pullback. And like, for instance, the first duel by the water's edge,
yeah,
at the beginning of the movie, it's such an amazing shot because you start on this close-up that doesn't feel like a close-up. It already feels like kind of a wider shot.
Is this when they're getting the guns ready?
Yes, when they're getting the guns ready, yeah. And that's already like kind of a whitish sort of medium range shot. And then it kind of starts to pull back.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody made this observation that at every moment during that pullback, if you freeze frame it, you have like a great looking composition that you could like print out, put up on a wall somewhere.
Right.
So it's not just that he starts on good composition and ends on a good composition. It's like through every stage of it, when like the tree enters the frame,
yeah,
and then
yeah,
like some more people standing around another frame. Uh-huh. And then by the time you get back, you've got the entire height of the tree on like the left side of the frame, like a beautiful cloud pattern in the sky,
yeah,
and the river. And like it's like compositions within compositions.
Yeah.
So that's that particular zoom lens that he used on a lot of the daytime exteriors.
It has a big – I mean, let's just talk real quick about that, the shot, the pullback shot.
Yeah.
It's a Kubrick move for sure, but he uses it so much in this movie. It becomes it's not overused, but it becomes a thing of its in and of itself.
Yes.
The way he reveals – and I started getting way into my brain about it. Like, is it even a metaphor of this character – who you start a movie on this teenager in Ireland, which is, you might say, a tight shot, and then you pull back throughout the entire film to reveal this 3-hour wide shot
kind of, the
of this
entire
guy's life.
Structure of society.
Yeah, it felt
way,
a little thematic, and that's probably a little, you know, reading it into what Kubrick was probably doing.
No, I think whether he thought about that consciously or not, I mean, it does make sense, and it does kind of – it mirrors very well, like you said, what the film is actually doing on like a thematic kind of narrative level, that it's also – it makes me think of like painting, where sometimes if you look at reproductions of paintings and books, where you'll have the entire painting on like one panel, one part of the page.
Yeah.
But then you also have like a detail that's like a blow-up enhancement of just a particular subject in the painting.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, it's like moving from a detail back to the entire canvas or something.
Like when you go to a museum, or at least I do, you stand back and look at the picture.
And then you move in real close.
Then you move in real close and look at the thing on the table.
And it's like there's things you can discover at both ends of the scale.
Yeah.
So it's a way for him to kind of mimic painting in a way, but also to do something very cinematic, which is to do all of that within the same shot, and it's moving. It's like a moving tableau or something.
And he's also pushing the audience away, literally.
Yeah, he's pulling you back. He's like, you're starting up close to this character, but then you're moving back, and it's just like, but also consider them in the context of their surroundings in this period of history. And
but tonally, like, if this film has been criticized for keeping the audience at arm's length, and he's constantly
pushing down against
back,
yeah.
It's kind of, there might even be a slight tongue-in-cheek knowing Kubrick. When it comes to stuff like that.
Because it is almost always a pullback. I don't know if he has any push-ins.
He has like, I don't know if he has a zoom-in.
Yeah.
He's got a couple of slow dollies zooming in.
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of static camera. And then the only time he goes handheld is when there's violence.
When there's a fight, yeah. So, yeah, the first one is the fist brawl in the army. That's handheld.
Which makes handheld super effective.
Yes.
When it's not overdone.
When he beats the crap out of Lord Bullington.
Oh, God, that scene is brutal.
That is an incredible scene. Just the tonal shift and the way the energy of the movie changes.
Yep.
Where it's like he's making this break with polite society.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's showing his true colors, kind of. and everyone is just aghast at what he's doing. And
it's so brutally violent.
It's so brutally violent and messy. And again, it shows like those kind of like barbaric tendencies that are just bubbling beneath the surface of like polite society.
Yeah, yeah.
And the handheld is a big part of that. And then it also happens again when Lady Lyndon attempts suicide. And, you know, that's a remarkable scene because we get very little of her like internal life, how she feels about anything.
You know nothing. Intuit what's going on
all
in her head.
All you can see is just when she's being mistreated, like when he blows the smoke in her face in the carriage, or when she's out walking with Lord Bullingdon and she sees him with one of the housemaids. It's all you see is her suffer, basically, in silence, kind of. And you have very little indicator of how she feels about any of it other than she's unhappy. Yeah. And in that one scene where she's just like knocking over the chair and screaming and it's handheld again. And you just kind of feel like, wow, okay, these are real living, breathing people. It's just that society requires them to not show any of that.
And that happens like twice in 3 hours. So it makes it so effective.
It's very powerful when it happens.
And it's funny too in the scene where he beats Bullingdon's ass and has like 10 people pulling him off.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, there's a little bit of Clockwork Orange right
there. Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, I had never picked up on this, but if you look structurally at Clockwork Orange, it's a rise and fall.
Oh, yeah.
And the movie is basically divided up into two halves. You have the introduction of Alex, and you have this progression all the way up until when he finally gets thrown in jail.
Right.
And then you have the whole second half of the movie with the Ludovico treatment and everything else, where it's like his downfall in a way.
Yeah.
And there's like a mirrored aspect where, you know, towards the end of the movie, he's like returning home to his parents again and finding out that they've rented out. So like it has this very clean one part rise, one part fall. And Barry Lyndon is the same exact structure.
Yeah.
Weirdly.
Yeah, that is interesting. I didn't think about that.
And if you think about Kubrick's fixation on symmetry as like a visual metaphor, he also is that way like narratively, structurally.
Right.
That he likes these, you know, bifurcated two halves of a narrative that mirror each other in some way.
Right.
So, yeah.
So back to the lenses and the candlelit scenes.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He very famously, as much as he could, especially in the exteriors, used natural light.
Yes.
It is a bit of a misnomer, the more I dug, that he, you know, you've heard people say he only used natural light for this film.
No, definitely
it's not.
Not
true. Yeah. A lot of the interiors, he apparently almost never had a light inside a room.
But he had outside the windows.
Yeah, he was casting
the daylight
light
constant.
And they would cover the windows, as you know, with it's called opal, but it's like a sort of a see-through.
Yeah, like diffusion.
Yeah, diffusion. Yeah. I guess if you don't know anything, I'm trying to think of listeners and how can I describe it. It's almost like wax paper.
Exactly, yeah.
That you would put over the window. So when the light comes in, it just gives a very even sort of glow.
Doesn't give you like that hard, direct light that casts really harsh shadows and goes to one specific point where you're aiming the light.
Right.
It just diffuses it so that it's more of like an ambient. It just brings up it's the like overall light level.
It's like light coming into a window.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the sun does.
Yeah.
And he wanted it to do it this way, not because he wanted to be Stanley Kubrick and be a pain in everyone's ass. He did it because they didn't have lighting back then like this.
He wanted it to look like it would have looked where most of your light's coming from daylight and candles. That's
and
what you had back then.
He achieved it through the use of those exterior lights and then very, very famously through the use of thousands and thousands of double and triple wicked candles.
Yes. And they talk about in the extras how these candles would burn down very quickly.
Right.
I assume they had to be, well, assume we can guarantee this, that they were mimicking the candles of the period.
Uh-huh.
They were not modern candles that might last longer.
Right.
So these candles burned down very quickly and had to be changed out after pretty much like every take or two.
Yeah, and the drips.
The drips
had to be
controlled,
scraped off or whatever.
They had to be, they had to design kind of special candle holders that would look period accurate, but also assist with these drips not getting on any of these priceless historical locations where they're shooting.
Oh, God, it's such
it's
a
like,
pain.
You know, anybody that's ever like been on like a location shoot or, you know, had somebody come to them to want to shoot in their house or something, like productions will promise, we won't break anything, we won't touch anything, we'll put it back just the way it was. And people that are maybe naive are like, okay, that sounds good.
Yeah,
and
then, don't ever do it, people.
And then, you know, boom, you bring in like a 40-person film crew carrying like heavy lights and gear and bumping into walls and knocking shit over. And
it's tough on a
house. Yeah, it's really, you know, it's
but
not—
But with historical landmarks, I'm sure they were insane about the people that they were working with that ran these places.
Mm-hmm.
It just, I can't imagine how tough that was.
Well, they said that some of these houses, you know, a lot of them probably are open for like tours to the public.
Uh-huh.
And they did not close them down to the public while the shoot was going on.
Oh, wow.
So if you happened to go to one of these houses while they were shooting,
they just corral.
They would just kind of corral and like rope it off. Like, don't go in that room because they're doing a movie
Stanley
in there.
Kubrick's
yeah,
in
Stanley
there.
Kubrick's shooting a little thing in there. But I believe in some cases they actually had to like stop shooting and let people check out the room for a minute.
Wow.
And move on. And then like, okay, we can pick up again.
Yeah, yeah.
So you just imagine like how often they're having to stop and start and reset and with the, between the candles and—
But the effect though is like stunning.
Oh, it's incredible.
Those candlelit scenes, there's just this warmth that like you cannot get from lights.
Yeah, there's no way to do it. Just the flickering of the light that you see on their faces. And if they were— Because I mean, obviously a lot of movies have— shot with candles in the shot.
Sure.
And then lit with something else
that's
a more constant, bright kind of source.
These are providing the light source.
You can tell they're providing the light source because they are literally, you see when the candle flickers, when it changes direction or something, the light goes away for a few frames.
Yeah.
And you see that flicker playing out on their faces.
The same was true in the exterior because they were shooting in Ireland for a year, which is like, you know, one of the rainiest, cloudiest places on the planet.
Yeah.
And there are long shots where he would, you could see the light change in the sky, which I know
it's beautiful.
Terrence Malick has done that.
But exactly.
Generally, you don't do that because it messes, you know, you have your aperture set, messes with continuity.
Yep.
But he had a special, I think a lens made that he could control the aperture as they were shooting.
Yeah, I don't
which
know.
Which is crazy. Like
maybe
this,
maybe they rode the aperture a little bit.
They did. They had one scene in particular. They had a special lens made where they actually it was like a still photography lens.
Yes.
That they had to retrofit to work on a camera.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They had to de-click the aperture.
Yeah, and I think there was two. One when he was being robbed, and there was another one. I can't remember which scene, but they said basically that they started and they moved like 6 or 7 stops to the end of the scene. It was wide open and
crazy.
Just which affects, you know,
depth of field
and like, you know, the slightest little jiggle with the camera like is amplified by a million.
So
just really technically
unbelievable
stuff.
There's one scene that I clocked last time I was watching it a couple nights ago where it's just a shot of like a road. The road is kind of on the left side of the frame.
Yeah,
the right side is just sort of trees and countryside.
Is this when the wagon's coming or whatever? Or not the wagon,
maybe,
but the carriage?
Maybe. I feel like maybe it was something on horseback, but maybe it's a carriage. But like the cloud actually appears to kind of move with him through the shot.
Wow.
Where it's like that was just one of those happy accidents, I'm sure.
Right.
But maybe they did it like 20 or 30 times until he was like, ooh, that was a good one. Like I like the way the cloud moved through the shot right as he was coming through.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things. Yeah, they talk about, especially like you said, in Ireland where – in those early scenes with Captain Quinn dancing and all that kind of stuff, like from one minute to the next, it's like it's rainy, it's cloudy, it's sunny.
Uh-huh.
And if you're going to have any kind of consistency at all, you just have to sort of wait for the sun to go back behind a cloud or come out or whatever effect you're going for.
Wow. One of my favorite parts is the section with the Chevalier.
Yes.
When they first meet, you know, he has been tasked to be a spy by
Potsdorf. And his crony, whoever that other guy is.
Yeah. The second, who was really the first. And of course, their meeting room, and, you know, it's like their little military office. It's just like a grand palace.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets tasked with being a spy. They say that this guy is a gambler and sort of a man about town, and you need to get in there and see what's going on.
Yeah.
And the narration when he meets him, he sort of looks like John Cleese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's in full like white makeup, and he looks like this dandy fop. And
he's got the eye patch.
Yeah, he's got the eye patch going.
It's got the really visible mole you see in so many people of that period.
That's the thing they put on,
yes,
though, right?
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Okay. I thought so. But he said the narration goes, right before he sells out his mission, which was instantly,
yeah,
the narration goes, there's many a man who will not understand the calls of the boast of feeling, which was now about to take place.
Yeah, yeah. I love that.
And
he
basically
telegraphs.
Just breaks down.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Just is like, I'm a spy. I'm here to spy on you.
Exactly.
And Podstorf sent me. And
yeah, yeah, yeah. He just spills the beans immediately.
Well, because he's daddy. And the guy gets up and just immediately hugs him. And then they have this, solidarity
They
together.
Both have this outburst of emotion.
Yeah.
You know.
For the time period.
Yeah, even though he's kind of having to, the Chevalier's reaction is a little more subdued. He's kind of patting him on the back, doing like a there, there kind of thing.
But that's now his son, in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And then they travel the country and Europe, gambling and going to salons and spas and cheating and ripping people off.
Yeah. And that is such a that technique of I feel like it's used a lot in comedies. It's almost a cliche at this point where, the voiceover will prefigure something somebody's about to say. Sometimes they'll even say what the thing is.
Yeah.
And then cut to the person saying the thing. That's a very common effect. But somehow in Barry Lyndon, it's not like a laugh out loud moment. But it is just a wry kind of wink and a nod.
Super dry.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. So back to lenses.
Yes.
Because we're not done. I mentioned NASA.
Yeah.
What did he do? He worked with NASA on a special lens, right?
So NASA had designed, and Zeiss working with NASA.
Right.
Zeiss, a very famous lens manufacturer out of Germany,
mm-hmm.
had made these special lenses that had an aperture of f0.7, which... If, just to briefly explain aperture and f-stops, the aperture, also known as the f-stop, is the ratio of the aperture to the focal length of the lens.
Mm-hmm.
So to make it kind of easy to understand, as the number is lower,
mm-hmm.
if it's, say, you're at an f1, that means the opening of your lens is equivalent to the focal length of your lens. So you're letting in a lot of light.
Yeah, the aperture will get wider and narrower, allowing in more and less light.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so the fastest available lenses when Kubrick was making this film, fastest available in terms of what was kind of commercially around,
mm-hmm.
might have been a 1.4,
mm-hmm.
But more likely a 2 or a 2.8, especially if you're talking zooms.
Mm-hmm.
For primes, you probably had some stills lenses that would open up to a 1.4,
mm-hmm.
and maybe some motion picture lenses too. But Kubrick, because he wanted to shoot in candlelight,
mm-hmm.
he needed a faster lens than that. Faster in the sense of lenses, in the sense of photography, does not refer to the frame rate you're shooting at.
Right.
When you say a fast lens, you mean a lens that gathers a lot of light.
Yeah, it means you can shoot in this case.
In low light conditions.
Super low light.
Yeah. So Kubrick had calculated that, our speed of film, the sensitivity of the film, is what they call an ASA of 100.
Yeah.
ASA is used interchangeably today with ISO. If you've ever done, video or stills photography, you're
uh-huh.
probably familiar with the ISO setting. The ISO is how sensitive the film is to light. And as that number increases, it has numbers 100, 200, 400, 800, and so on. Every time that number doubles, you're getting another stop of sensitivity in the light.
Yeah.
In the sensor. And so what Kubrick was planning on shooting on was just ISO 100 film. And they were going to rate it at 200 and then push it one stop in the development.
Yeah, and what that means, everybody, I know we're getting into the fucking weeds
here.
But pushing is when you develop something not as it was intended to be developed.
You develop it for longer.
Yeah.
And
as if it were a different, not film stock. Well, maybe film stock sometimes.
Yeah, kind of. You treat it, you basically just let it develop for longer so that more of the image, the brightness of the image comes through, but at a cost of you're also exposing more of the grain in the image.
Yeah. So I remember in film shoots early on, they would change the film over and they would tape the can shut and somebody would say, push that two stops.
Exactly.
And they would write that on the tape so the lab would know to develop it specifically that way.
Yeah. And sometimes, a lot of people would do that for almost aesthetic reasons, especially as you get later on into the lifetime of film. There were faster films around.
You
could get 400 or 800, but you might still shoot on 100 and push it a couple stops because you actually want that grain pattern to come through and to give you your image that kind of like texture to it. But in the case of Kubrick in the 70s, I think he was shooting on 100 speed film because usually the lower the ISO of the film, the more kind of colorful and vibrant and rich it's going to be, the less grain there's going to be. So you get just this beautiful, pristine kind of image that was very important, for instance, for like the daytime exteriors to kind of mimic that of paintings. If you shot that on like 16 millimeter or if you shot it on, you know, a faster film, there would be more grain in those scenes mm-hmm. and it would kind of spoil the effect in a way.
Yeah.
So all of this is kind of setting up to say Kubrick had a real problem. Mm-hmm. He had like a math problem or a physics problem where it's like these candles only put out so much light. They literally put out 1 foot candle, which is a popular kind of way of measuring light.
And that was with double and triple wicks.
Yeah.
And
doing everything they could.
Hundreds of candles.
Yeah.
Sometimes right under someone's face.
Yes. And so he had this problem, right? We've got 100, you know, ISO or ASA film. We're going to push that one stop to 200
mm-hmm.
because that's still going to give us an acceptable level of grain.
Mm-hmm.
By pushing it to 200, okay, we've gotten one aperture closer to this problem.
Right.
But at a 1.4, we're still not there. We're still way under.
Yeah.
So how do you get faster? Well, he was reading an article, I believe an American cinematographer, that talked about these lenses that Zeiss had developed for NASA. And the lenses, again, had an aperture of f0.7.
And this is so they could shoot in space.
This is so they could shoot like the dark side of the moon, basically, yeah. And so that is a full 2 stops faster, which means it gathers 4 times more light than the 1.4. So, but it was not that simple. It was not as simple as like getting the lens from NASA and slapping it on the camera.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they were never
made to fit certain cameras.
Exactly. Yeah. And the design of this lens had nothing to do with motion picture cameras.
Yeah.
So Kubrick had to have someone modify one of his personally owned cameras to fit the lens so that it was literally just a few millimeters away from the film gate.
Uh-huh.
So a very, very narrow tolerance for any kind of error.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in precision. If it was off by just a millimeter one way or the other, the image would probably be out of focus.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a vignette or it might be a little too cropped in or something.
Yeah.
So he had to get it just right. Had to design an entirely different like viewfinder system for the camera so that when they were actually rolling, they could still see what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the combination of pushing the film a stop, doing everything they could with the candles.
Amazing.
Using this, you know, incredibly kind of technically advanced lens from NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we mentioned earlier, as you open the aperture up more and more, you're letting in more light, your depth of field gets more and more narrow.
Right.
So in these, you know, it was a 50 millimeter lens, which is for 35 millimeter cameras, that's kind of like a portrait lens.
Mm-hmm.
If you're accustomed to like shooting full frame, it's more like a 70, 75, mm-hmm. something like that. So it's not a wide lens. It's more of like a medium close up kind of lens. And as your focal length goes up, that also reduces your depth of field because you're in more of a close up situation.
Yeah.
And so if you had the subject about 8 feet away from the camera, then your depth of field was equivalent to like 1.7 inches,
mm-hmm.
which means if anybody leans forward the slightest bit,
leans
back, you're immediately out of focus.
Well, that's one reason why everyone was so still in a lot of these shots.
Yes.
Not only did he want to mimic the painting, but the actress who played Lady Lyndon said, you know, we had to remain still because we would be out of focus if we moved a fucking inch.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Kubrick had to come up with this system where his focus puller, like it's just unreasonable to expect a focus puller to be able to eyeball the difference of a couple inches from 8 feet away or however far away he is. So Kubrick actually came up with this idea to have a second camera, a closed circuit TV camera that would be kind of perpendicular to the side of the actor.
Yeah.
And then they placed a grid over the monitor that was showing the image from this closed circuit TV camera. And there it was like lines, vertical lines going down the picture from the profile of the actor. So that when the actor did lean forward, there were measurements noted on this, you know, overlay that would say the distances. And so he could look at that line.
Wow.
In the actor intersecting with that line and move the lens, you know, move the focus ring accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the whole movie like that. You know, whenever they're on these dimly lit candlelight interiors,
which is a lot.
And I mean, so, it's incredible. Like, if you watch that movie, like, certainly the images of the candlelit interiors, they're soft.
Uh-huh.
They have a beautiful softness to them, but they're never out of focus.
No. And like, people that don't, if you're not super technically savvy about some of this stuff, like in the last like 8 minutes just went over your head.
Right.
When you watch this film in an era and a year especially of some of the best looking movies you've ever seen, Barry Lyndon stands out apart from those even.
Even that,
and like,
yeah.
While you're watching this movie, if you're like, man, this thing really looks great, that's why.
Yeah.
you know, like such great preparation and care and thought and inventiveness went into making what you see on the screen. And that's why scenes like one of my favorite shots is when the soldiers, when that house is on fire.
Oh, yes.
And the soldiers have torched it.
Yeah.
And they are leaving with like some of the supplies that they have raided.
Yeah, yeah.
Just kind of marching slowly away.
Yeah.
And that bit of narration too is he kind of sells out the era and the military, because the narration kind of straight up says something like, you know, during this time period, we think of them as of noble and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But like kind of what you're seeing on screen, I wish I'd written down the exact quote.
It's something to the effect of, I know the shot you're talking about, and the bit of narration I'm thinking is it comes a little bit later where you actually see them, some Prussian soldiers marching by with what looks like just like random kids and like,
yeah, they've got like
young people, and like people that are not, you know, farmers, people that are not like trained soldiers.
Yeah.
It just says, you know, we think of the military, we think of like the king and so on as being these like dignified, high ranking people that there's sort of like an honor in going to war and bravery and so on. But actually, in order to keep the ranks full, you know, because basically the king needed like cannon fodder,
mm-hmm.
They would just have to take anybody into the army.
Yeah, it was sort of an indictment of war and the military and nobility.
And it just kind of goes by like
all in one quick little line.
Yeah, it says so much.
Because it's not even the grand statement of the movie.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
Just part of that world, you know, that they basically just need warm bodies to catch bullets, you know. It's brutal.
I'm looking over my page here trying to think of a couple of my favorite parts. Lyndon's the former Lyndon who dies, his death scene is one of the great scenes in movies.
Yeah.
It's so over the top and like just that guy's just chewing through scenery.
He tries to open up his pills and they spill out onto the table.
Yeah.
And then he's wheezing and he's on death's doorstep, you know.
And Barry Redmond had just left the room saying, he who laughs, laughs.
Exactly, exactly. And it's so interesting, the effect that, the voiceover creates there, where you're still seeing this person alive moving on screen, even though he's like struggling to catch his breath.
Yeah.
But the narration says, you know, Lord Lyndon passed away not long after.
Yeah.
So you're seeing this person as they're still alive, but you're hearing that they've died or that they're going to die very
soon.
Well,
and you, even before, as a first-time viewer of this movie, when they're sort of facing off right there, the guy, Lyndon, was getting so worked up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, he's going to die.
Yeah, he's going to keel over right now.
He's about to have a heart attack.
Yeah.
And that's just what happens.
Yeah.
It's so funny. And again, but played a little bit for black comedy, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It's so over the top.
Yeah. And just the sense that, like, you know, if you have any notion that your wife loves you or something, the fact that he's dying, he's not long for this world.
Sure.
And he's already seeing his replacement, like,
oh man,
just slide on in and, you know, and he can't do anything about it. And it's like, just, the notion that his whole life has just been for nothing, for a sham, you know?
Yeah. And that's a bit of a like the notion of the May-December thing, like the old man with the young, you know, the 60-year-old man with a 25-year-old girlfriend.
Yeah.
That's all fun and games, but he knows, in real life,
those
men know that woman would rather be with someone closer to her age.
Yeah,
like deep down, they maybe have the money,
mm-hmm.
and they may have the notoriety or the wealth or the fame.
Yeah,
but like at the end of the day, this character, and in real life, these guys, they see the Ryan O'Neills come into the room.
Yep.
And the way their wife looks at them.
Exactly.
And all the money in the world won't change the fact that you're about to fucking die.
Yeah. Yeah, it's brutal.
Really interesting stuff.
It's interesting, too, because at the beginning of the movie, what is Redmond Barry doing? He's kind of resisting this almost sort of arranged marriage that's going to happen between his cousin and Captain Quinn.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the family says it outright. They're like, this Captain Quinn is worth 1,500 guineas a month, you know? It's like—
That's why they fake the duel.
There's no talk of romance. There's no talk of he's a good guy or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's just like he means a lot to this family financially, the bottom line.
Yeah, they straight up say
it. So it's very much like, you know, an arranged marriage or something.
Yeah.
And young Barry, kind of like idealistic Barry, wants to resist this and believes in true love and passion and so on.
Yeah.
And then he gets a little bit older and soon he does the same exact thing where, sure, she is a beautiful woman, but he clearly doesn't love her.
Right.
And he just— It is entirely about him rising through the ranks and kind of legitimizing himself as part of this higher rung of society.
Well, and then his mom at one point kicks it up a notch because she's like, you're with Lady Lyndon and this is great. And I think in his mind at that moment, he's like,
He thought he was set.
I'm done.
Yeah, exactly. He thought he'd done it.
Yeah, and the mom basically says, you don't have a penny to your own name.
Exactly.
And you are a bad accident away from being broke.
Yeah.
And so that's when he starts trying to ingratiate himself to the larger upper crust and achieve title or whatever.
And that sets about his downfall financially.
He's the cause of his own demise.
Yeah.
He is the agent of his own son's death.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I know this film, I'm not defending it by being a cold sort of detached thing, but I will say this is the only movie I've ever watched where a child dies and I didn't like even get a lump in my throat.
Really?
No, man. During that, I was just like, all right, this is happening.
Interesting.
And I got into the acting and Ryan O'Neill breaking down.
Yeah.
But I wasn't myself like upset.
Wow. Interesting. I don't know. Sometimes when I watch it, I do have more of an emotional response, and sometimes it is more of that kind of slightly distance feeling. But I do find that to, you know, at least on certain viewings, depending on how I'm feeling or whatever, I have kind of gotten more choked up during that part just because—
And I might on a different day too.
Yeah. Something about the scene that really got to me was when he's in bed and his head is all bandaged and he can't feel anything other than like just his face, I guess.
And he's paralyzed, I think.
He's paralyzed, yeah. And he talks about his body being very cold and he just asks his parents straight up in that way that children do.
Am I going to die?
Am I going to die? He just comes out and says it. There's no beating around the bush. There's no tact. It's just the curiosity of a child that doesn't know this is not necessarily the kind of thing you say out loud, you know?
Yeah.
So he's just, you know, am I going to die? Will I go to heaven?
Right.
You know, I'm very cold. I can't feel anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I don't know. There's something so sad about it to me. But, you know, I also didn't get emotional watching it this most recent time. But it has affected me that way before.
Well, it's because the character of Barry is not one you attach yourself to emotionally.
True.
It was interesting. I was thinking about a lot of the criticism that like Pauline Kael, very famously in The New Yorker, said Kubrick has taken a quick-witted story and controlled it so meticulously that he's drained the blood out of it. It's a coffee table movie.
Yeah.
We might as well be at a three-hour slideshow for art history majors. And I just didn't see it, man. Like, it's a three-hour film, but it needs to be because where you start with that character is Redmond, like, I get the, what is he, like 18 or 19?
Yeah, something like that.
Like Redmond Barry at the beginning of that movie and one-legged Barry Lyndon hobbling into that carriage at the end.
Yeah.
When you think about that, you've gone through a journey.
You've seen a life.
That
yeah.
you would not have gotten in 2 hours.
Oh, for sure.
You know, it's necessary to be this long. And it is slow, but I was never bored.
No, I don't find it a boring movie at all.
Fully engrossed.
Every scene, if you're on the movie's wavelength, has humor. It has kind of commentary on the world at the time or the interior kind of change that's happening within Barry Lyndon. There's nothing dull about it. There's just too much going on in every scene. They all feel like they have a purpose and they're propelling things forward and they're giving you more information about this period of time. And some of them do proceed very slowly, but I mean, it also allows him to have these like incredibly beautiful moments, like the scene where Lady Lyndon leaves the card game table and walks outside and is kind of lit by like moonlight. And you have this amazing contrast between like the blue night lighting of the exterior and the warm interior lighting through the window.
Yeah.
And that wonderful tracking shot as Barry walks out to meet her.
Yeah, and kiss her
and
for
kiss
the first
her.
Time.
And the movie just really takes its time and draws out that moment. And it has the quality of like just a wonderful, like, classical kind of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
There's something so movie-like about that that particular moment.
But also real of the period, too. I think I don't think people – it's not modern-day New York City. I think there was a more languid pace back then.
And Scorsese talks about that, actually. I think it's part of a Life in Pictures documentary that is all about Kubrick. But Scorsese – says, you know, what Kubrick did with the period film is he took it back in time. And he actually allows you to feel the slowness, the pace of life in that period, rather than being kind of this amped up, like, don't get bored.
Like modern day take on
a period
piece.
It's a much more slowed down, subdued. And once, if you're willing to go with it, to just like surrender to the pace of the movie and just become completely engrossed in it, I find it, I mean, it's one of those movies that I could watch 100 times over and over and over again and never get bored with it.
You will, Casey.
Yeah.
You're going to hit 100.
Maybe I will. Maybe I will.
I already can't wait to see it again, but I for sure want to see it on the big screen.
Yeah.
With great sound and like, because the music, I mean, we haven't even gotten into that.
Oh, man.
Like Kubrick, of course, loves classical music. And in this movie, he has free reign because it is during that time period.
Absolutely.
So he just goes nuts with it.
He does say that he cheated a little bit.
Because time period?
The one of the main themes, the saraband, the dun, 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 that I believe is from maybe 30
later.
Or 40 years later than the film takes place. But
he gets a pass for that.
He gets a pass for it. And in the extras, they talk about how he was considering all kinds of different music for the film, trying different things in the editing room. Probably looked at doing, you know, an original score to some extent.
Yeah.
And then finally, like quite late into the editing process, decided, actually, I'm just going to go with all, you know, pre-existing music. Still re-recorded it and did all kinds of different arrangements and orchestrations of it for different purposes because sometimes you have that theme just on like timpani.
Sure.
Sometimes you have more like a full orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's played and like during the duels, it's more of like a suspenseful kind of version of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes when things are more tragic and emotional, that's when the orchestra comes in and the strings are swelling and it has more of like that tragic dimension.
Yeah.
So it's a very versatile piece of music as well. And it just gives like this amazing consistency to the movie that it's like the same tune being played in different registers depending on it. It works so well, yeah.
Yeah. All right, we only got a few more minutes, so let's go ahead and finish on that final duel.
Yes.
There's three duels that sort of beginning, middle, and end this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And the final duel with Bullington is played in real time, and it's long.
Oh, I love it, yeah.
Like the setup, but again, it's all just – he could have trimmed 3 or 4 minutes, but why?
Absolutely.
Like the way they show the rules and the sort of how stiff it all was and how you had to go about it. And this duel is interesting too because it was the only one where they didn't fire at once.
Yeah.
I know there were different kinds of duels.
Yeah. And
but this was we take turns shooting at each other.
It's very interesting that, you know, you flip a coin.
Yep. To see who shoots first.
See who shoots first, who's going to fire and who's going to receive fire.
Yeah.
And you notice they turn to their side to make themselves at least a little bit more narrow than facing straight on. And again, it's this absurdity. It's the idea that, you know, what you're doing is somehow proper or gentlemanly or something.
And they're in that great barn.
Yes.
With the birds.
Yeah. The doves.
It was the only one that wasn't exterior.
Yeah.
But that made for some really like great frames and
gives you the sound of the doves kind of going rustling and just such a sense of place and everything. Yeah.
And Bullington's one of my favorite like reactions in the whole movie is when his gun misfires.
Yes.
And he's like, I need a different gun. Uh-huh. And they're like, no, that was your shot.
That counts.
Like
your
that
gun
counts.
Discharge. So he's just like, it's your time to receive, you know? Yeah.
So Lyndon, you know, fires into the ground
and
takes sort of the, even though he fucking hates this kid.
He hates the kid.
He
but
refuses. And he would have killed him probably.
Oh yeah.
Cause he's a crack shot.
Yeah.
And he fires into the ground and you think for a moment, like he's going to let it go. And they ask him, and I think everyone's kind of like, we're all good, right?
Yeah.
And he just looks and is like, you know, what does he say? I have not received satisfaction.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, oh, man.
Yeah. And
but
then,
did,
and then right
know?
There you see in Ryan O'Neill's reaction in his eyes, you just see him.
Yeah.
It just washes over him like, my life is about to take a very drastic turn.
Yeah.
You know,
he's not killed.
He it's like he wants to be magnanimous in that moment. He wants to do this like honorable thing.
Yeah.
And sort of like settle things amicably so that maybe Bullington can be reintegrated into the family.
Right.
They can all live together happily ever after.
And still be rich.
And still be rich.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Bullington just takes that all away from him.
But that's the only way that movie could end. Like, Barry Lyndon in the end cannot stay in a place that he has not earned.
There's no ending if he does that.
Yeah.
It's just like,
he has to be kicked back out.
Yeah.
Because he never belonged there.
No.
You know, to begin with.
He has to kind of regress back towards where he started.
With a short one leg.
Funny tidbit from, again, from some of the extras on the Criterion. Leon Vitali is actually vomiting in that scene.
Oh, really?
He's
so upset.
They fixed him a lunch that day that was meant to be deliberately disgusting. That was like cold soup and like chicken and just this nasty concoction.
Boiled chicken.
Yeah. And even that wasn't enough to get him like physically sick. And so they went to plan B, which is that they cracked open a raw egg and had him swallow that down. And he said, as soon as it went down, I could feel it coming back up immediately. And so when he's standing there about to receive fire and he has that first little bit of vomit that comes out, that is real true life vomit. He runs over to the corner and he gets really sick and you kind of hear that off screen.
Uh-huh.
And Vitali said he was petrified that Kubrick was going to make him do it over and over again.
Right.
But in fact, Kubrick said, nope, that was great. Like it was a natural reaction.
The only
really
one,
vomited.
The only one take Kubrick ever
exactly,
did.
Exactly. That was like the one time he ever did just like a single take is he didn't put Vitali through it over and over again.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right, man. I know we could talk for another hour. I feel like we did it.
Oh, I'm so glad you saw the movie. You enjoyed the movie.
Thank you for picking this one.
Absolutely.
I don't know. It's just one of those that was on the list that I never got around to. And I never even knew quite what it was. I'd seen bits and pieces through documentaries. I knew it was that era.
Mm-hmm.
But I was always just like, what is Barry Lyndon? And now I know.
It took me, even when I watched it in high school, like it was one of the last ones I got around to.
Yeah.
Because I had that whole first Kubrick box set and I kind of worked my way through the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And then eventually it was just kind of like, all right, I got 3 hours to kill. I guess I'll check out this like lesser known, lesser appreciated Kubrick movie. And I was just blown away from it.
And again, like so many of his movies, appreciated much later than they were at the time.
Big time.
It's sort of, I mean, not every film he did, but he had a weird thing about people giving them a second look years later. Because now this is regarded as one of the great masterpieces of all time.
And I think it absolutely deserves that reputation. I mean, it's just, you know, when we were talking about The Shining, that's a movie that I'm very comfortable like picking apart and kind of nitpicking. And I look at it almost as more of this kind of like object.
Uh-huh.
But Barry Lyndon is, to me, is almost perfect.
Yeah.
There's very little that you could point out as flawed.
Mm-hmm.
It just feels so tightly constructed,
so meticulous,
so incredibly executed that it's just this incredible kind of masterpiece, I think.
It's more than a movie. I know that sounds cheesy, but it really is.
Yeah.
All right, good stuff, man.
Great.
Thanks a lot, Casey. Part 3 coming soon, everyone.
Looking forward to it.
Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at HowStuffWorks Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.